And welcome back, guys. This is I Eat Movies number 27. I'm, of course, your co-host, Mike, joined by my good pal, Dino, and we are very pleased to have you guys back because for the second time this season, we are joined by a very special guest, one of the earliest supporters, one of the earliest and greatest supporters of I Eat Movies, one of our favorite cinephiles in his own right. You may know him from the decade plus long blog that he's run, Rupert Pupkin Speaks, which contains some of the best film news, reviews, and lists a cinephile could possibly hope to find. He also runs the Just the Discs YouTube channel, where he covers Blu-ray reviews and his latest hauls of physical media. In addition, he's also the co-host of the Pure Cinema podcast with his pal Elric Kane, the official podcast of the New Beverly Cinema. We are pleased, overwhelmed, overjoyed to welcome Brian Sauer to I Eat Movies. What's up, man?
What's up? Very, very kind, Mike. Thank you for the introduction. And again, I'm honored to be here. I'm honored to be the second guest, I think, on the show after our friend Mr. Hertzberg.
Yeah, That's right. You're second. Yeah, awesome.
Very cool.
That is right. We've been throwing this idea around for a while because, as Mike said, Brian has been a very vocal and very encouraging supporter of this podcast and of us. And we had a couple concepts and we decided to settle on this three-spoked attempt to look at some 80s sleepers. Well, it's an attempt. It's an effort. So,
no, I just like the spoked. I like the sort of touch on my...
Not
my
bespoked, pick. But yes. It's like a tricorn hat. Well, forget it. It's fine. but nevertheless, we each picked one movie, a sleeper film from the 80s, dividing the 80s up into early, mid, and late, and we're all going to discuss each of those movies.
Mm-hmm. That is that's the general idea. I think we're going to definitely go along this journey chronologically. So we're going to hand it back over to you, Dino, and that's going to kick things off in 1982 with Hit and Run.
David, thank you for coming. Can we hurry, please?
Sure. Do you want to go the same way or do you have a secret, more mysterious route?
Any way you'd like, just so we make it by 10 o'clock.
Is this drugs? Is that what we're doing?
No.
How about guns? Revolution? Robbery? Politics?
Really, I can't say, but it's nothing like that.
What is it then? Hey, I'm involved here. I could get in a lot of trouble if you get caught.
Get caught at what? Really, David, stop it. I told you I can't tell you. And if you're my friend, you'll just leave it alone.
Roger.
Look, I do appreciate what you're doing for me. I really do. And I'm sorry I can't tell you, but trust me, it's a private thing, personal. All right?
All right. Hey, it's none of my business. I took the job.
Well, I'm glad that you took the job.
So am I.
Hit and Run is a movie I just discovered, I think, about last year or so. The previously mentioned Jonathan Hertzberg brought this movie to my attention, and it's totally in my wheelhouse, though it's obscure enough that I was just telling before we started recording, I was just telling Mike that I had to add a lot of the IMDb details into the database.
Oh,
because
wow.
Most of them weren't even in there like a year and a half ago or so. Hit and Run is directed by Charles Braverman, brother of the perhaps better known actor Bart Braverman. It concerns a story where Paul Perry, in his, I believe, first film role, plays a New York City cab driver and teacher who lost his wife in a hit and run car accident and is struggling to get past the emotional scarring of that. He picks up a woman who asks him to drive her from Manhattan to Darien, Connecticut for like $150 or something several times, though she refuses to let him tell anybody where she's going or what she's doing. And he becomes embroiled with her, gets emotionally involved with her, and one day discovers by going into the house that he has been driving her to, he discovers the body of a man who turns out to be the man in his memories who killed his wife in a hit-and-run accident. It becomes a frame job. It becomes him on the run trying to figure out who has framed him, and the action goes on from there. So the two of you just saw this for the first time, and I'm curious what you thought.
And thank you for introducing it to us. I think it's probably best to kind of announce at the top of the hour that this is a fairly deep cut. I don't know about you, Brian, but I had to go resort to YouTube to watch it, and probably not the best presentation, but definitely certainly watchable. So it's definitely a deeper cut, and I do believe you can watch it on Amazon Prime through Freevee. You have to bear with certain chapter marks that have ads, but you can watch it through there. So and you watched it on VHS, right, Dino?
No, I actually watched it. I watched a version, basically the same thing as what you guys watched. I believe you both watched it on YouTube.
I watched it on Tubi.
Oh, on Tubi? Perfect. Okay,
there you
cool.
go.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think there's a very good version of this. I think there's a tape, but the versions online, like, they vary only slightly. Unfortunately, this is one of those movies that might be lost or not make its way to a proper restoration.
Oh,
but yeah. But any thoughts on this one, Brian?
Fascinating movie. Thank you so much for turning me. I mean, definitely a discovery for me, a movie I'd never heard of. Intriguing to me that Hertzberg's involved, that he, you know, not surprising. It's definitely a cool movie in that way. Yeah, really, really interesting. Never heard of it. And I was really into the main actor, Paul Perry, as you mentioned. Like, there's just something about, he reminds me a little bit of, like, oh man, I was going to say, like, somebody from The Thing. Who am I thinking of? Richard Mazur, I think.
Oh, yeah.
A tiny bit of, like, Miss Richard Mazur, just in the look. But, yeah, he's just a fascinating actor. And the setup is like, oh, I'm like, okay, we're going to do some Taxi Driver stuff. Meaning like Scorsese style Taxi Driver. And I'm like, nope, right away they drive out of the city and it becomes this whole other thing. And I was just like, wow, where's this going? And it's got this sort of like, you know, film noir Hitchcock energy about it. And yeah, I was really into it, you know? And I also noticed that, I had little notes here, but like one of the notes, the things that stood out was that it looks like they use the same diner car that's in After Hours at one point.
Mm-hmm.
That's
like,
interesting.
It looks like the restaurant that Dick Miller runs is some kind of a diner car type place.
Yeah, I had a very similar like hunch on that too. Yeah,
I think it's the same. It looks legit like the same stuff during the day as opposed to night, where Griffin Dunn and Rosanna Arquette are having dinner or whatever. They're hanging out at that coffee shop. But yeah, so I was like immediately like, oh, this has got ties directly to After Hours. I love that. And yeah, no, I was really intrigued to see where it was going, you know, ultimately. And the score was fascinating. I really dug the score, you know. I don't know too much about that, Dino. Is that something that
I didn't, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I didn't do that. But because we were kind of condensing an episode.
I see.
Not doing our usual, like, you know, six pages of notes each and me stepping over like every fifth word Mike says type of thing.
It's actually a trademark of the show.
Yeah, well, there you are. It's trademark of my family anyway. But if you, I didn't do as much work on locations, but that is one of the things on the music or the locations, but the locations are, since you mentioned leaving the city, one of the things that really sucked me in on this, because it basically goes into my area. It goes into an area that I'm very familiar with. It's basically like the locations, many of them are accurate. When you see him initially driving Claudia Kron into, you know, outside of the city, they're going up the Henry Hudson. They're going up roads that I drive regularly. And the areas, and even in Connecticut, that it concerns, the original story is, I think, called $80 to Stamford. And the movie takes place in Darien, or is supposed to take place in Darien. And I drive past these places almost every day to work. So it's not only grounded in that way, in a sense of the geography. And you know, there's a mention of New Jersey. We do have a delegate from New Jersey here.
Rahway, New Jersey. Yeah, where I actively go to Rahway, which is only 10 minutes from my house. I actively go there almost monthly to see a 35mm film presentation. So yeah, nice. That was kind of a nice surprise. But somebody clearly knew Rahway, New Jersey, because they make two references to where Paul Perry's character lies about taking a fare to Rahway and comments on how nice it is, and then his boss makes a comment about how, like, it's not that nice of a place or something yeah. there. So somebody wrote that with clearly the experience at hand to say that, because they knew firsthand.
There's a flea market I like in Rahway, but I think it's better, and it's across the street from the thing that people most know about Rahway, New Jersey. Now we're off in New Jersey anyway, which is a jail. There's a prison in Rahway. But nevertheless, not only did the locations really speak to me, and the idea of going back in and out of the city, Mike and I are both suburban, greater New York City area guys, and so this is like normal for us, the idea of driving in and out of New York City. But I also really like the tone. Like, it had it automatically, for like a scrappy, relatively B movie type production, it already had a brooding kind of like dark tone to it. Like, the idea that this character comes out the gate and we know he's dealt with some serious emotional trauma and is still working on it. I thought they did a pretty good job of communicating that with, again, a movie that, you know, it's clearly not the most high budgeted type production.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I would say the other thing that really stood out to me, well, there's a lot of stuff, the old guy character played wonderfully. Will Lee, who is Mr. Hooper from Sesame Street, he sounds a lot like and reminds me a lot of Eli Wallach in this. And so just having him in there and then knowing also he's Mr. Hooper was this crazy, like, wow, Mr. Hooper is just kicking ass in this movie. He is a huge highlight as a supporting character in this movie. I loved it.
It's funny. Sorry, Mike, just a second. It's funny, too, because his character is talking about like union efforts and arranging and so forth. And I started looking, like, barely had to look him up. And I'm like, I have a feeling this guy's a leftist. He was blacklisted. Part of the reason
there's
a big gap in his history is before Sesame Street is because he was acting and then he got blacklisted. Mike, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just going to, you know, piggyback off of Brian's comment. But yeah, Will Lee is a real bright spot in this, being in Sesame Street for, I think we discussed it, like roughly about 160 episodes. So he was deeply ingrained in that production. So, you know, getting a gig like that where I believe Sesame Street has been and still shoots in Queens, New York, I'm sure once he got something like Hit and Run, although it's obviously a modestly budget affair, you could really tell that this guy sunk his teeth into it, because being in the world of, you know, episodic television for so many years, it probably was really refreshing to him to kind of sink his teeth into something like this. And I think it comes through really well on screen. As much as I really took to the character of David Marks, I felt like Paul Perry and Claudia Kron, who plays the role of Diane, the fare that David's taking around in the film, I felt like they were a little pedestrian, but I don't necessarily think that's a fault on their own. I feel like it's very early on in their careers when you look back at their filmographies and what have you, and just being, you know, knowing what kind of production this was. I do feel that Hit and Run feels like a product that from someone who was ingrained in the world of television, which, Charles Braverman, Hit and Run is really the only feature film that he did. He was more or less a TV guy working on things like Sledgehammer, Beverly Hills 90210, you know, many, many more credits in that vein, television movies and stuff. But I think that he still does a very commendable job shooting New York City and shooting it as cinematically as possible. We get a lot of city highlights. We spend several moments, you know, early on in the film where we're in the heart of Times Square. So that certainly couldn't have been an easy thing to kind of maneuver, whether, you know, it was like, you know, with permits or not. But he achieves, a really fair amount in more intimate locations, like we talked about, like the Munson's Diner, because, of course, this is an IE Movies episode. We have to talk about food to some degree. But yeah, like you said, I really liked that there was something very cushy and warm about those, New York City diners that only New York City can provide. So I did really like that. Although, like I did mention, that as much as Perry and Kron felt kind of pedestrian in their performances, I think the film's engrossing plot really more than makes up for these kind of trivial shortcomings in the long run.
Yeah, and I wouldn't disagree with you, Mike, but I would say that the Kron character, for whatever the performance is maybe lacking or not, she's just weird enough for me to be like, what the hell is going on with this girl? You know, and that it almost works to the advantage of the character that I'm just like, I just can't get a read on her, you know, and that helped me in terms of like just kind of like his dealing with her and what was going on with him. And yeah, it's intriguing, but again, I don't disagree in terms of the performances. They're definitely interesting, but there's something about Paul Perry though that has a certain, I don't know, naturalism or something to him that I ultimately bought into and ultimately pulled me into the plot a bit somehow.
I definitely don't want to fault his authenticity as a New Yorker. He felt like a real New Yorker to me, like somebody who genuinely would have been driving a cab. Sure. So I do buy into that. I just felt like the acting chops weren't necessarily up to snuff. You know, obviously, other better actors could have come into these roles and probably ran a little bit more with them. But as is, I still think that they do a fine job given, you know, the limited experience that they had at this point. I'm sure Dino's going to mention this too, but, you know, in addition to Will Lee, there are some other people that pop up in this film. I know at the start of the episode, you mentioned Charles' brother, Bart Braverman. Mm-hmm. Has a role in the film. He plays a feminine news reporter when the cameras, of course, aren't rolling. At the time, he's a newscaster that is reporting on, you know, the happenings that relate to the David Marks's character. And I felt like he really stood out a lot because he was humorous, but he just had a personality. So in his limited screen time, he really kind of stood out. And then you see who is it? Frederick Coffin from Mother's Day and Wayne's World plays Captain Jardine, and the great Mike Starr from Ed Wood.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite films plays the Copador man. So you see these people in these very minor roles, you know, understandably at the start of their career. So it was really comforting and cool to see them in some, you know, a deep cut such as this.
Yeah, I'm a huge Mike Starr proponent. Any appearance of Mike Starr anytime is a big boost to any movie.
For sure.
I agree. Yeah. Braverman, of course, is one of the more recognizable people for television. That's Bart Braverman. He's best known for Vegas. Bobby Binzer Borso from the Robert Urich, Phyllis Davis TV show, Vegas. I didn't realize this until I looked it up. He was a child actor. Mm. He's 2 years younger than his brother, Charles. Acted from the 50s to 1962, presumably, you know, went to school and started acting again in 75. He's probably best known to people from Alligator, where he also plays a reporter.
Yeah.
But he has a bunch of interest. He's long resume, especially television. The both Bravermans mostly worked in television, but it's interesting that Charles Braverman got his start. I think he went to USC for film, but he got his start working for CBS. So with all his TV work, TV movies, TV series, even stuff like, what did I find? The Secret Tapes of the OJ Case is one of the more recent things he did. I think it's fun that he has his brother in a cameo playing like a sleazy television news reporter, considering his roots are in news. nevertheless, he also has this thing I couldn't resist. Well, we're going off again, but he made a 1986 TV movie called The Prince of Bel-Air. Did you either of you notice this?
I noticed that, this. Yeah. It's almost like it's him and it's Kirstie Alley and
Mark Harmon.
And Mark Harmon. So it's like a prelude to Summer School or something.
Yeah, it's like that's from 86. It's before and it doesn't involve any Will Smith whatsoever, it seems.
No.
So there's that, which is kind of interesting. He also produced Charles Braverman also produced something called A Pug's Life. The Dogumentary, which apparently his wife directed, but I just couldn't resist A Pug's Life. Anyway.
What about Brotherhood of Justice? Didn't he direct that?
I think that's
one of the ones now this is one that I want to say it sort of ties into one of the later films we're going to talk about because I think Kiefer Sutherland is in that with Keanu Reeves. And I want to say that hopefully I didn't screw this up because it's one of those TV movies that's like, yeah, no, it's definitely him. He's listed as director.
Hmm.
But yeah, it's like, it's actually not a bad TV movie. High school students, you know, rich kids kind of going after each other. And it's Keanu, Kiefer, Lori Loughlin. I remember kind of enjoying this and having it on VHS at the video store I worked at back in the day.
Sounds great.
It's kind of fun. I mean, it's dark, but it's kind of fun. Anyway, that was one where I was just like, oh, there's a movie that I know. I can't remember any other films from this guy, but that's really interesting. But this is a fascinating movie, Dino. So again, thank you for, you know, the recommendation. Sure. I was just one of those where I was like, where is this going? This is so unexpected and so not what I was thinking it was going to be, you know?
Yeah.
I just quickly want to note that it was written by Lucille Fletcher, who I should say that one of the original ideas we were kicking around for this episode was Brian and Mike basically slapped me around with their knowledge of classic cinema, which would be easily done. But Lucille Fletcher is best. Her biggest success was Sorry, Wrong Number. She wrote Sorry, Wrong Number, the Barbara Stanwyck movie, as well as the Twilight Zone episode, The Hitchhiker. But Sorry, Wrong Number was adapted in, like, there's like a whole bunch of adaptations of it.
Yeah.
She also, she just seems to have done quite a few thrillers. She's credited for writing for, she's listed as uncredited for writing Creepshow 2 and Night Watch from 1973. She was also married for like 35 years to Bernard Herrmann, which I think is really interesting.
That is just crazy connections.
So it's like, it's based, and again, this is based on a story she did called $80 to Stanford, written by Don Enright, who wrote the screenplay, who, he produced, Search and Destroy, Private School, and Private Resort, and Next of Kin, and he wrote Spasms. There's a connection between the production team and William Fruitt as well here. So there's some interesting connections on this
one. I like that.
Unfortunately, because of the rough quality of it, there's that one scene where you're looking at like the letter, where you can't really make out what the letter says. So there's a bit of the plot gets fuzzy as the resolution got fuzzy. Basically, the letter was a bank letter, where a loan was called in by the bank, which has kind of spurred the whole frame up plot of this movie. Mm-hmm. I got a little bit better resolution version of it, so I could make it out a bit, but I don't think the YouTube version is all that clear.
Yeah,
nevertheless, I think it's a neat movie. It really retains a bit of like maybe like 70s character. It is 82 in terms of just having a little bit more brooding, moody depth to it. And I should also note, since this is 82, there are these great scenes of the subway, interior scenes of, you know, graffiti covered subways. New York City would not allow that, I don't think, after 82, maybe 83. The transit authority basically put the kibosh on that. So this is like the end of the period where you could show such things for the most part.
So they would straight up stop you from showing graffiti subway after.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, under the Koch administration, that was definitely like an initiative. There's some in Coming to America, I think, but it was definitely getting harder. And currently you can get arrested for filming anything on the New York City subway.
Really?
Yeah. Because what they started doing is they started limiting any shooting. This is something I kind of covered a little bit in the commentary that I did for Dreams Don't Die. They would limit shooting only to certain areas in the subway where they could control any production, like Hoyt and Schermerhorn in Brooklyn, where the subway museum is, or part of the subway museum is, and so forth. Basically, they clamped down on it because all the 70s movies that showed the grid of New York City, there was a concerted effort to show less of it or permit less of it to be filmed. So they wanted more and more control. And this movie falls into like the end of the era where you can do that. So anyway, we should keep moving on unless you guys have any other notes.
I do want to make one mention because we did mention just very briefly Brad Fiedel's score, which frankly, it's better than the movie deserves. And Fiedel would probably go on to his biggest success just 2 years later, scoring The Terminator for James Cameron. But I love the score. It's a nice juxtaposition between synths and saxophones. Really great stuff. And another thing that I like to kind of throw on this film that I liked a lot, where once the David Marks character is kind of embroiled in this thing, you would think that this would kind of run the same routine as one man against the system. Now he has nowhere to turn, but that's not exactly what we get in this. And I did appreciate that. It seems to be that everybody that knows David knows him so well and intimately that they don't believe any of that. So he has sort of a whole web of people that are fighting for him. I mean, you have the Will Lee character. You have seemingly the entire fleet of the New York City Yellow Cab Taxi Company, yes, looking out for his best interest, and then you know, the babysitter to his children. So I thought, oh, that's really cool that, like, it's not really him. Like, he has, like, a really great support system that's trying to help him clear his name. So it's a subtle difference, but a difference nonetheless that I thought was kind of, you know, it was interesting to see that in a film like this.
Yeah, I'll second that, Mike, especially the cab stuff when they're helping him out, you know, and everybody's sort of like,
yeah,
it's reminiscent of, like, you know, vaguely the CB craze kind of movies when you have, right, truckers helping other truckers.
Yeah.
But it's like, in this case, they're looking for a girl in New York and everybody's on his side trying to help him out. And, you know, obviously this is pre cell phones, pre anything. So it's really great to see the New York cabbies come together. I like that a lot.
Yeah,
I didn't see that. I think I'm glad each of you mentioned those things. But yeah, that was one of the things I thought was interesting, because I don't feel like I've seen that used in other movies. That idea of, like, you know, like the cabbies are working like the truckers would in a trucker movie. By the way, thank you, Mike. I totally did not write down. As Mike McPadden would say, I've failed you. I've failed our audience. I did not write down that Brad Fidel did this, but this is 1982. So this, just like Dreams Don't Die, another connection. Brad Fidel did the music for Dreams Don't Die as well, in the same year.
There it is.
Cool.
A vastly underseen Deuce-based tale. So I want to definitely appreciate Dino for bringing that to both our attentions. That is Hit and Run for sure. So I guess moving on, we're going to journey into the mid-80s, or cycle on, as I should say, into the mid-80s. And Brian's selection for us is going to be 1986's Quicksilver.
He wasn't just good, he was the best.
I'm going to sell every option I can get.
What are you doing, John?
I lost it all. Everything.
Quicksilver.
Jack Casey's just landed.
7th Avenue, two together, go!
I don't have half of what you have. In a world where the pressure's off.
I'm on the street, I feel good, man. I feel exhilarated. I go as fast as I like. Street sign says one way east, I go west.
Risk is purely personal.
Driving a bike and delivering junk, that's for you?
I don't have it anymore. Nor the nerve.
Hector said you were some kind of big head honcho once.
Survival's an instinct you learn on the streets.
Well, if that's the case, and Jack is so smart, then what's he doing here?
In essence, something you don't know nothing about.
This isn't about business, is it?
Is a feeling you never lose.
You have all these choices that you can make.
Now, Jack Casey's climbing back.
Get out
his way.
I'm staying with it.
When you have nothing left, all you really need,
check it out the floor,
is the courage to get it back. Kevin Bacon. Quicksilver.
Yes, Quicksilver. Well, again, I apologize because, well, here's the thing. I had watched it, I want to say 3 or 4 years ago, and I think I was just really entertained by its oddness. You know, it's an odd film. And
you're our guest. You're not supposed to apologize. We're supposed to apologize to you.
No. But see, like, in rewatching it, I realized that it's not the crazy, bonkers, entertaining thing that I thought it was. Although there is a couple scenes in it that stand out as, like, the things I remembered that kind of drew me to it. But, you know, I would say if you're going to watch a Cycle Messenger movie, Premium Rush is a much better, you know, thriller in this vein. And it'd be an interesting double bill with this. But anyway, so, and Mike, you had mentioned that Kevin Bacon points to this as an all-time low in his career or something like that. Which is intriguing, especially because you set that great video of, there's a video of him recently looking for a poster for Quicksilver in the New York City subway. Like, this just happened. Like,
this recently just happened. Yeah. Like, you, I mean, Dino can definitely speak more to this, but in the New York City subway system, there's always subway posters that are, you know, advertising movies or Broadway shows or, you know, cigarettes or, you know, whatever it may have been. But, you know, and a lot of the times they don't necessarily strip a poster down. They just kind of glue and paste over it. So what had happened, there must have been one frame and they were peeling away layers and layers of age-old posters, decades-old posters, really, and it turned out that there was a Quicksilver poster underneath many of them, and it was hung up for several days or what have you, and Kevin Bacon on his Instagram sort of made Quicksilver go viral very, you know, on a very small scale, where he went on a hunt in the New York City subway system to find the Quicksilver poster, but alas, they had actually taken it down before he could see it, but it was still a pretty funny and entertaining video.
Yeah, it was kind of like Geraldo Rivera's vaults or whatever. Just like didn't quite pay off at the end.
Al Capone's vault. I watched
Al Capone's,
that live.
That's right. Al Capone's vaults. I totally remember that. What a bummer. But anyway, but so it's an interesting movie. I will say this. It's definitely an 80s movie through and through. And the cast, I think the part of me really just enjoys this cast, you know, which includes Bacon, Jamie Gertz, Paul Rodriguez, Rudy Ramos, Lawrence Fishburne, Louis Anderson, and there's a bunch of other, you know, recognizable faces in here for sure. So I think that's part of it for me. Sometimes an 80s movie that's nostalgic with a cast that I like can be buoyant enough to sort of, you know, be fun to rewatch. But the basic idea is that Kevin Bacon plays a stockbroker, and he opens the movie with a, you know, this crazy mustache, and he's a stockbroker, and, you know, just to spoil the beginning, he's like a hotshot, like he's doing really well and even gets his dad in on some kind of investment and then completely blows it. And he has this really heavy moment with his dad where he tells him we lost everything, and his dad tries to play it cool, and Kevin Bacon goes to leave, and then he comes back and his dad doesn't know he's come back, and his dad's just weeping at the table, like just lost all his money. And Bacon's character is obviously totally traumatized by this and quits the stock market game altogether. And there's a bit at the beginning where he's actually having a cabbie try and chase a bike messenger, and the bike messenger wins. And I think something about that interaction cues him to the idea of, I'm going to be a bike messenger now, you know, much less responsibility. I can't let people down, you know, all this stuff. And so he becomes a bike messenger in San Francisco, and
hold on
at least
a second.
Feels like San Francisco.
That's one point I wanted to ask you.
And Mike brought this up too, and it's totally an interesting point because there
Where
feels
is
like
this movie.
It's supposed to be San Francisco, but I think Mike brought it up too. It feels like a conglomeration of New York and San Francisco somehow.
Yeah. So I
and Los Angeles.
Cause yeah.
In LA too.
I mean, what there is a very prominent, you know, competitive race sequence in this film between Bacon and Fishburne, which is unmistakably San Francisco.
Yeah.
But then in other moments, it's New York. Basically, they did shoot the majority of this film in Los Angeles and San Francisco, with some shooting for New York locations. But apparently, the director, Thomas Michael Donnelly, envisioned this to just kind of have a very generic urban landscape. So it's like, it's any metropolis USA, but that still doesn't gel, because you're like, that friggin' road is absolutely San Francisco.
Yeah, that's,
you know, anybody that's never even been there knows that's San Francisco.
It's it's a bit distracting in that way. And I guess I kind of wish he had committed to one city, because at least that would give the character of that single city as the backdrop. So it is a little confusing, but I think it's supposed to be San Francisco, although you're right, it clearly is many things. But so he takes up his role as a bike messenger. He starts to fall in with Jamie Gertz, who's kind of a tough girl dropout, and Paul Rodriguez, who's like, you know, this guy with hopes of, you know, starting his own hot dog stand franchise. And Lawrence Fishburne is like just sort of one of the hotshot bike messengers who's gotten himself involved with Rudy Ramos, who's like a drug dealer who sometimes has these bike messengers carry drugs for him. And, you know, that causes a sort of a turn in the plot at one point. And Rudy Ramos is just sort of creeping around the movie in a car, ultimately watching the bike messengers a lot. I like him a lot. I wish they gave him a little more to do in this movie because he's a really good character actor. But yeah, so it's sort of it revolves around Bacon in this world and then sort of involving him. You know, the movie has some weird side plots that I think ultimately are to its detriment. One of which is like helping Paul Rodriguez get a loan for his hot dog stand, which includes like a pretty ridiculous scene where Bacon re-enters Wall Street and we get to see him sort of trading, but it doesn't really make any sense at all in terms of what he's actually doing. And
yeah, I don't know about you guys, but I call me ignorant, but like I've never understood the stock market. So while like they're trying to shoot that film, you know, shoot that sequence cinematically and exciting, I just see people yelling and handing each other slips of paper. I'm like, really? I was like, I know what this is supposed to mean. He's down, he's up, he's down, he's up. But I'm like, I don't know what any of this actually means. Like, I'm only going to know if this is good or bad if he walks out with like a sour puss and tells Hector he didn't get it, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
no, it's true. I mean, it really does take the sort of dramatic oomph out of some of those scenes. Cause at first you're like, oh, I think he's doing good. And then he comes out and he's like, I had a rough. And I'm like, oh, okay. I guess I didn't really know what was going on there. But anyway, there's something inherently 80s about it. And having Bacon, Jamie Gertz, Paul Rodriguez, and Lawrence Fishburne in a movie to me is sometimes enough to just make it an interesting curio. And I think the scene where Lawrence Fishburne and Bacon race is the one that stood out to me. It's just kind of like, what is going on? This is fascinating stuff. And I don't know, there's something about Larry Fishburne. I just think of him as such a bigger than life presence. And seeing him riding around on a skinny 10 speed is just bizarre to me because it just feels like he should be on, I don't know, something bigger. It just feels like, he wouldn't be caught dead on a 10 speed, but that could be just my own interpretation of how cool I think Larry Fishburne is.
Oh, you're not alone. Yeah. Fishburne was definitely the standout for me in this film. If there was any casting to get praise, he deserves it.
Yeah. So that's stuff. Go
I'm
ahead.
Sorry. I just wanted to say you opened with an apology. I want to apologize that the movie I selected didn't have Jamie Gertz in it. So we can't call this episode Show Me Where It Gertz. Okay? I'm sorry about that. But and that race scene is definitely in Los Angeles, by the way. Okay. And there's, you know, the Nate Starkman building is in this. It's completely like there's that whole thing. Yeah. And it's like, where is he at the world famous San Francisco Stock Exchange? Like, where's the anyway, nevertheless, I thought this was, you know, I thought this was easy to classify, this movie, because it reminded me of exactly, honestly, it was a good selection for the middle 80s, a certain variety of the middle 80s, but like it reminded me of things like DC Cab, like the Playing for Keeps. It's a very kind of, it kind of relies on this idea that it's like an urban cartoon, like all these different urban characters in that. So besides Los Angeles and here we are in New York City in traffic and okay, now we're in, you know, Boyle Heights or wherever in LA, there is that completely over the top, like, backlot of like the urban area outside Quicksilver. Like,
and I do love that. I love backlot pictures because I mean, to cinephiles like ourselves, it's very identifiable to us. So there's a comfort that I take from backlot movies. So seeing that backlot urban street utilized a lot was actually very comforting to see.
Yeah. And I mean, this reminds me of stuff like, of like The Last Dragon or even like, you know, Rad is the easy comparison because they have to have the flash dance style, like show us your chops. Like let's all, you know, let's all compete on motors on our bicycles kind of routine. Yeah, you know, it's a light movie. I'll say that. It's certainly that, and it has a certain commercial texture to it. I agree with you. Look, I love Rudy Ramos. I love the fact that he's driving a car just like he was. Well, he wasn't driving, but nevertheless, he's in a car in The Driver, which I love him in. He's one of those Latino actors like Pepe Serna, who was like in everything for like, you know, 10 years. One of those main like Latino actors who got a lot of work in this period of time. I can't deny it. Like this is still in that period of time where they were throwing comedians into like everything, whether or not they're really good. I mean, Paul Rodriguez is, I love Paul Rodriguez, supposed to be like a super nice guy in real life.
Yeah.
I don't know how well used he is in this, but
agreed.
The point at which like Louis Anderson has like two things to do in this movie. One of them is hit somebody with a bicycle fork, which I thought was pretty great. And the other thing was to issue like a racist joke to Paul Rodriguez, where he throws him a can of Krylon spray paint and says, "Hey, I got you a new pen," which reminds me of
I missed that joke.
It reminds me of like those mid-80s truly tasteless joke books type, you know, level of racial humor that we seem to think was acceptable back then. But nevertheless, it kind of goes down easy in that way. Like I said, I did watch movies like Playing for Keeps as a kid. I don't think they're very good movies, but they entertained me at that time. And I love the impossible 80s loft also.
Oh my God.
If you live in any city that's not, if you live in any like major city, the idea of like, oh yeah, we got this huge old ancient loft that's got much more space than we need and we can somehow afford it while we're bike messengers. I like that too.
I feel like they almost try to qualify that by saying his girlfriend apparently is like a very well-to-do ballet dancer, maybe. Yeah. I don't that he's sponging off her, but it does also allow them the space to do that ridiculous only in the 80s. ballet/bike, you know, dance that they do, which you brought in Rad, and that has the greatest bicycle boogie scene ever what's the spark song music that you can dance to?
It's real life.
That music you can dance to comes on after real life. Yes, you're 100% right. Thank you, Dino.
I'm a glutton for, you know, gratuitous 80s films, and that Dino knows this better than anybody, but that sequence in Quicksilver definitely is definitely that. And I do like unironically love that sequence because it is like something that would only emerge at this place in time in the 80s. And that actress too, I have to bring her up, the gorgeous Whitney Kershaw. She was a trained ballerina who plays Bacon's girlfriend early in the film, but she doesn't have too many credits to her name. But the one that I think people, because I was watching this film and I was like, man, she's gorgeous. I know her for something. So I had to look back. Like I said, she doesn't have that many credits, but the one that will definitely stick out to people in this era, she was probably best known as playing Miss Hassenfuss in a season 4 episode of The Wonder Years, where she plays this an attractive dental hygienist that Kevin Arnold becomes smitten with. And I'm like,
I almost remember that. And
I love that episode. And forever. I was like, that's right. She was gorgeous in that too. That's why it stuck with me.
That's hilarious. Miss Hasenfuss?
Miss Rabbit's Foot. The name translates to Miss Rabbit's Foot. And she wasn't so lucky in this movie because she has like next to nothing to do in this film besides look pissed off once or twice, right?
Yeah. Pretty much.
They gave her almost nothing.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll say about this movie is, and I think part of it is, for a while, and still to this day, I was obsessed with 80s fad movies. And, you know, like we've already talked about Rad. I mean, there was just a lot of bike movies. There was just, whether it was BMX or, and this falls a little at the edges of that kind of bike exploitation, if you will. But like, there was a time when bikes were just a big part of the zeitgeist. And people
were,
the Dirt Bike Kid. I mean, there's tons of bike movies, you know, BMX Bandits and all this stuff. So, you know, it's funny to me just, and then you have the sort of adjacent like skateboard movies and things like that. So I feel like this is, again, just sort of in the outer rim of that faddish area. And I just find, again, only in the 80s do they really put something like this together. It just doesn't really gel fully as a movie, but like it has enough of these little 80s bits and this cast and stuff that it stood out to me in some way. Again, it's not a great movie, and so I wish I'd picked a better movie to my
movies. You're welcome here. We love flawed movies. Flawed movies are often more interesting than like the classics, because no one can say anything interesting in many cases about a movie that everybody loves. So true. Flawed movies are often the ones which are like, wow, 80% of this movie works, and let's identify what's good. And like, we don't apologize for that. And we love flawed. I know you like flawed movies as well.
I mean, that's part of our whole bit on Pure Cinema is, like, you know, when we do five films because, it's because, you know, we're not going to talk about favorites because that's where you get hung up and that's where you get the nerds coming in at you. Like, what about this? What about that? Well, if it's just a movie I find interesting, then it can be anything. And that's one of the reasons we, Elric and I, are still going strong in that show is because we haven't tried to push ourselves into top fives or best ofs or anything. It just, that's not fun. I think it's really, you know, you can get caught up in like a lot of 3-star movies, but I think there's a lot of 3-star movies that, I mean, based on the classic now Letterbox scale of 5 stars. But you know, I know Dino's not as much into, but that's how I think of movies now. So when I think about a 3-star movie, that's a good movie and it probably has some interesting things in it and some interesting things to talk about. So I'm glad that there was at least some of that to offer for Quicksilver.
Yeah.
Well, in the same way that people are like automatically negging some of the biggest, like most heralded movies just to kind of be obnoxious online. That's like, that's a common Letterbox thing now also.
True.
It's like there should be people who are going to try to defend movies that everyone else hates. Because if you could find something, if there's a couple good, if you really like Jamie Gertz looking annoyed, that there's a lot of that in this movie and in the next movie as well. But if you could extract things out of movies that most people are not paying attention to, you're still doing good work as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, no, I agree. And there's one more. Oh, I just looked at my notes and there's something I should mention because I feel like Hertzberg will be upset if I don't. I mean, he isn't the hugest Warriors fan, but I think he likes the Warriors quite a bit. Oh, yeah. And David Harris, Cochise from the Warriors, is also part of this troop. So he's great in this, and it's great to see him. And so I got to mention him. So like, because when I think of the Warriors, I think of a lot of people, but Hertzberg is definitely one of the people I think of. And so I got to mention those actors that I know stand out. So anyway,
I'm sorry, Michael, just quick. Before I forget, I also liked how, like, the opening sequence, the point where the Kevin Bacon character, we're meant to believe that he sees the other side in this jerk off bike messenger who wants to race a cab. But I like how the guy loses his beret and then Kevin Bacon immediately adopts it. Like he starts wearing the beret of the random cab, the random bike messenger. Like it goes straight from like that's, you know, it, again, these are 80s movies. They rely on very obvious visual cliches. They rely on things like the, you know, almost forcedly multicultural group of people and gang and so forth. Anyway, Mike, sorry, go ahead.
No, I know that we were kind of having a laugh at the absurdity of this film and that there is, you know, there's a lot of absurdity, especially once you get to the final climax and you have this drug dealing hood kind of going, you know, toe to toe with the bike messengers of this city. It's absurd, but like there's a lot of fun to be had. And the fact that there is a cast like this of Kevin Bacon and Larry Fishburne, Louis Anderson, Jamie Gertz, etc., and people might look at this and be like, wow, they really have not a lot to do. Like, what a great supporting cast. It's only a great supporting cast retrospectively because we know where all of these people ultimately ended up. But guess what? Everybody has to start somewhere. So it's really fascinating to kind of turn back the clock and think, wow, Larry Fishburne was in a bike messaging movie with Kevin Bacon. And this is 86, so this is right at the time that he was Cowboy Curtis on Peavy's Playhouse. Everybody starts somewhere. So it's fascinating to see that somebody like, you know, Thomas Michael Donnelly, who directed this, amassed a cast like this right as all these guys were ascending. Does the movie work? Not, you know, extensively, but there's a lot in here that, like you said, it's a fad movie. There's a lot of, you know, music video montage-y stuff that was very, you know, in vogue at the time. And I think that it's probably done fairly well here, I think, too. And all the, you know, obviously real, you know, bikers that are very accomplished doing stunts, there's that whole thing where they're kind of showing off during the whole, like, you know, urban backlot area. They're doing all these cool tricks on the bike. So, like, you know, like, that's entertaining. Like, that stuff was very entertaining to watch, as entertaining as it is to watch people popping and locking and breaking, you know? Like, it's one of those things. And one other person that I did want to mention, because we've kind of brought up that open sequence where Bacon's in the cab and he's trying to outrun the bike messenger. His cab driver is actually Dick Warlock, who is Michael Myers in Halloween 2 and Kurt Russell's longtime stunt double. So that was cool to see him pop up, you know, just kind of in a random role, sharing, you know, scene with Kevin Bacon. But yeah, you know, like I said, as much as we've kind of had fun kind of, you know, poking and prodding this movie, this film definitely kind of ascended or attempted to kind of be in the wake of a Footloose. I think I mentioned in my Letterboxd review, it's trying to capture that same sort of modern folk hero thing, whereas, you know, in Footloose, it's about a kid trying to resurrect dancing in, you know, a repressed town. I think they were really trying to capture the same sort of magic and Quicksilver. It doesn't always work, but, you know, like you said, it's a fad movie, and I think being released at the time that it was, I think that it captures the stuff that it was trying to do fairly well, you know. So as you said, as a curio, you know, it's still something to check out.
Yeah, I mean, I think the last thing I would say about it is that, you know, as much as it has all these flaws, I do think with a crowd, if you put it as a double bill with something else, I think you get an interesting I'm thinking of the New Beverly Dino, like that crowd. I feel like they would have fun with this movie, and not necessarily at its expense, but just because there's just some weird stuff in this and some very 80s stuff. I just feel like if you sat a bunch of people down in a room and they watched it, and I think a lot of people either never saw this movie or maybe they saw it, as you mentioned, Mike, on HBO a bunch of times way back in the day. I just feel like a lot of people aren't talking about it right now, and that's understandable. But at the same time, with a group of people in a room, I think it could be kind of a fun watch. That's just my last word on it.
I just want to say that I'm glad I watched it, because I remember the commercials, and I was riding a freestyle bike at this period of time as a kid. I remember the commercials, and I'm like, the TV spots were really cool for this movie. I can't deny that. I remember those as a kid. But okay, here's some homework for anybody listening who's made it this far. This is a drinking game waiting to fucking happen. Every time you see the license plate switch from blue to yellow, take a drink. Every time you know you're in Los Angeles, you know, or you see like a New York telephone number on the side of a truck because you're no longer in San Francisco, you know, try to avoid alcohol poisoning, please.
That's hilarious.
Don't hurt yourself. But that's a drinking game waiting to happen.
Definitely.
Yeah, so I guess that about does it for Quicksilver. That wraps up our mid-80s portion of it. So I guess it's up to me to kind of close us out with the late 80s. And I selected from 1989, Renegades.
My old man used to always say you gotta trust somebody sometime.
My dad used to tell me that when I did, I picked the wrong person.
You seem to get along fine, Chief.
Okay, Joe.
What are you, crazy?
I'm not a chief, so don't call me Chief. My name is Hank Storm.
Let me see the money, Chief.
Sorry about that, Hank. Buster McHenry.
First sign of trouble, I'll break your neck, Buster.
Come on.
When has McHenry been working undercover?
He's doing something on his own.
Don't need any help. No backup.
Now slowly, so I can enjoy it. Tell me you don't know what he's working on.
Trust me.
You're the cop they're looking for in the papers, aren't you?
Freeze right there! You're under arrest!
Look over my shoulder and tell me if you see an Indian following me.
Yeah. Oh, we're fine.
Renegades.
Well, I'm having a good time. How about you?
So Renegades is a Philly set picture that was mostly shot in Toronto. It stars Kiefer Sutherland, who plays Buster McHenry, an undercover cop who plays by his own rules. After he rubs elbows, you know, he rubs the elbows of fellow officers the wrong way after assisting in a car stop that goes wrong, ending with him slapping another detective, as these things happen. Buster's locked up and put on thin ice. he's infiltrating a crime organization in bed with a dirty cop. And then a diamond heist that he's involved in also goes wrong when civilians are killed, a spear from the Lakota tribe is stolen, and Buster is shot and left for dead. Enter Hank Storm, who's played by Lou Diamond Phillips, a descendant of the Lakota tribe. He pursues the criminals on foot in hopes of retrieving the spear during a chaotic car chase that sees Buster driving a getaway car through streets, on sidewalks, through storefronts, when a police cruiser crashes in and out of a moving truck in pursuit of them. It's at this point during nursing Buster back to health that Buster and Hank begrudgingly decide that they have to work together now that they have a common interest. And that's basically the plot of the movie, whereas Buster sees that he was there's a dirty cop involved, and now he's obviously getting, you know, the short end of the stick, and he needs to kind of sniff out who this dirty cop is that's kind of in bed with these, devious criminals, whereas the Hank Storm character is just kind of hell-bent on retrieving this heirloom from his native tribe. So they kind of band together to work together now that they have this common interest. It's a buddy picture. At the heart of this film, it's a buddy picture. And as we all know, the buddy formula goes back to the days of Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, Jerry Lewis, and Dean Martin. But I'd say it was the 1970s that would embrace a more hard-edged stance within the genre with films like Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, Busting, Freebie and the Bean, Scarecrow, Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, Hickey and Boggs. The list goes on and on. But I would argue that it was the 1980s that arguably perfected this buddy picture formula with films like 48 Hours, Beverly Hills Cop, Harlem Nights, another I Eat Movies selection. If you've noticed, I just named three Eddie Murphy movies in a row. That was not intentional. But of course, you know, going down the list, you have Lethal Weapon, Running Scared, Midnight Run, Shakedown, Tango and Cash, Turner and Hooch, Dead Heat, They Live, Blues Brothers, The Killer, Twins, you know, the list goes on and on. So I really think that the 80s really kind of leaned into this and, you know, really kind of took the formula and ran with it for the majority of it. This film I kind of happened upon because Mill Creek just recently put it out on Blu-ray within the last year in sort of a cool VHS style slipcover release. So it was kind of cool to see that make its way into the HD arena. What I think is probably most notable about this film, and I think why I kind of made it the selection, is that it's directed by Jack Sholder, who, yes, you know, of course, horror fans would know from helming things like Alone in the Dark and Nightmare on Elm Street 2, but he also did one of the best buddy pictures of the era, and that's 1987's The Hidden. So it kind of makes sense that he would gravitate to something like Renegades, although he didn't really want to. I don't know if you guys know this, but at the time, he was actually looking for the next great script, and he was actively pursuing Ghost. But he didn't get the job. Yeah, he wanted to do Ghost because I guess it was, you know, circulating and he knew how great of a script it was. But it was actually Universal who came to him. He didn't seek them out. Universal came to him with Renegades, and that's why he took the job when he did.
Can I just do a real quick Jack Sholder tangent?
Oh, please.
Two things. One, I always have to shout out 1201 whenever he comes up because, yeah, I love The Hidden. I think it's great. 1201 is a TV movie he did, I think, for Turner, cable movie. And it's basically Groundhog Day played straight. And it's, I can't remember the story it's based on, but it stars, Jonathan Silverman, Helen Slater. Has Martin Landau and Jeremy Piven. Actually, that's the highlight, but it's basically like, Silverman works at a company, like a science lab kind of company. And you sort of come to find out that he's involved in the time loop, and slowly you figure out what's happening. I think it's really fun. It's one of my favorite Jack Sholder movies, and so I always kind of have to mention 1201.
Cool.
I think it's only on DVD. I don't know if it's streaming. But I was just looking at his filmography, and this is just a weird aside because purely my daughter has gotten us on a Jaws tear. I showed her Jaws 2 first and Jaws a long time ago. And lately she's been wanting to watch shark movies. So we watched Jaws while we were away on vacation. Then we watched Jaws 2 and we watched Jaws the Revenge. But there's something that stood out to me in Jaws that I've always remembered. And that's the scene where Dreyfus and Scheider are trying to convince Murray Hamilton of the, you know, seriousness of the shark. And he's like, tell him about New Jersey. Tell him about what happened. Mm-hmm. And there's a movie that Jack Scholder directed here called 12 Days of Terror from 2004. And it says in the synopsis, it's July of 2016 was a time of, and it's basically that it's that, it sounds like it's that shark attack where four people were chewed up in the beach surf in New Jersey. And I'm like, wow, he did the movie that they're talking about in Jaws. And I was like, okay, now I have to see 12 Days of Terror. So anyway, that's my weird side, but I love Jack Scholder and I love that you picked a Jack Scholder movie. So that's,
I like Jack Scholder too. I just think it's interesting that, you know, for his fourth movie, he ended up in this buddy film and then went straight to TV movies for a decade. Yeah. So that tells you a lot about how Renegades was received.
It's true.
Yeah. Yeah, to say the least, Renegades was not particularly well received. I think it was made on like $16 million budget, only made 20. And I found an interview that Jack Scholder had conducted. And he talks actually pretty extensively about 1201 because the interviewer, similar to you, Brian, really took a liking to 1201. So Scholder was like more than enthusiastic to talk about 1201.
Oh, I gotta see that.
Yeah, so he was talking about Renegades because the interviewer, again, also kept going back to Renegades because that was another big film he wanted to discuss with him. And Jack Scholder, you know, he admits that, you know, the buddy formula is cliche by, you know, all standards. But, you know, coming off of The Hidden, he felt like he did a really good job with it. And I think he did, but he cites the moment where he knew that the film and his career were on the downward slide. He talks about, I guess it must have been at a some like industry event where I guess they preview the trailers for the upcoming summer blockbusters, and Batman was on the docket as well as like several other big blockbusters at that time, and Batman comes up in the audience is, you know, hooting and hollering and going crazy, and then the trailer for Renegades came up and it was silence, and he's like, this is definitely gonna be a downward spiral now.
Oh, that's rough. Yeah, I've forgotten about the context of 89, summer of Batman. Yeah, this is not gonna go quite as well.
Yeah, this is definitely definitely not gonna go the way that I'm sure he envisioned. But, you know, I'm happy that at least in that interview he does kind of come clean and says that he thinks that he did a good job with it. You know, it was a good story, he had a great cast, all of which are true in this film, although, you know, by design it's sort of, you know, especially in 89, as entertaining as these things are, it is sort of paint by numbers as far as the buddy formula does go. But yeah, I thought that it was cool to see this cast. You know, obviously Kiefer and Phillips had appeared together before, you know, just a year before in Young Guns. They would reunite again in 90 with the sequel. They also did a film in 94 called Teresa's Tattoo, where Sutherland appears in an uncredited role, and Phillips would also join Sutherland in an episode of 24. So they have a long history together. They work really well together, and I think that that comes through here really well. I think that probably the best stuff in this film is, you know, the action set pieces. There's this really great car chase that I referenced in my synopsis where, you know, it's right after this diamond heist, and Sutherland is acting as now the getaway driver for, you know, the lead baddie Marino and his thugs. And they take off through the Philly streets. Toronto streets, through the Philly streets, and you know, it's just going crazy. And Scholder, again in this interview, talks about how he had every intention of topping the car chase that he did in The Hidden, since that was so well received. So I think he spoke to his stunt coordinator and he's like, I want to do the best thing, the best car chase yet. So he was using the French Connection as his basis. And I think originally the sequence was intended to be 9 minutes long, and his stunt coordinator kind of threw all these ideas at him, and they settled upon the whole idea of that police cruiser sort of going up the back of a moving truck and kind of plowing through the inside out the other end, which is fantastic. It looks great in the film. You know, through the editing process, he cut the scene down to 7 minutes, which shows a lot of restraint and know-how, because he talked about that too. He's like, you can say a lot of things about my films, but the one thing that I think is a constant is that there's always really good editing in my films. And I think that if I would have kept that sequence to the intended 9 minutes, the audience, once you lay the rhythm out for them, the audience gets accustomed to it very quickly, and then they get bored, and you don't want to lose that momentum. So that's why he cut it, which I think is wise, too, because I think as is, the sequence is like probably the centerpiece of the film, although, you know, we have a lot of great shootouts. There's a really memorable salon shootout that happens in this film, and then the climax where Sutherland and Phillips' character kind of, you know, tail Marino to this like cabin hideaway, and then all hell breaks loose with, you know, an inferno and runaway horses and all this crazy shit going on. But yeah, you know, I think from an action point of view, I think that it, you know, does all of that stuff pretty well for a late 80s actioneer.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I didn't have this prepped, but the DP on this was Phil Mayhew, or it's with an X, an English DP who also did Scum, The Long Good Friday, The Final Option, the TV movie of Max Headroom, Fourth Protocol. He has some interest. The Highlander 2 was what he did right after Renegades. I think. You know, that chase scene made me think, well, I think if this movie's referencing things of the period and buddy movies of the period, two of the movies that immediately came to my mind are two of my absolute favorites, which are Running Scared and Midnight Run. From the moment that Kiefer Sutherland goes into the diner at the beginning and sits down and lights up a cigarette, because in 89, everyone had to smoke in every fucking movie, if you don't remember, if you guys haven't noticed this, lights up a cigarette, drinks some coffee, and reads the paper. And actually, like, that set me up really nicely. The chase scene you're talking about, especially on the railroad tracks, makes me think of Running Scared chase scene.
Yeah.
Of course, that's directed by, you know, Peter Himes, a DP himself, so you kind of can't compete with that. But what really struck me about this movie more than anything, I honestly, even though, like you said, Mike, they have all this history together, I feel like the pairing of Diamond and Diamond Phillips and Kiefer Sutherland never really sparks for me. I can't tell exactly what their relationship is supposed to be, why the cop would trust this random guy. I like that this movie goes straight into action without much exposition at all, but I almost feel like there's this really slow ramping up of a relationship between the two of them, and it ends in this bizarre, like, line where it's like, hey, I'm in the hotel visiting, you know, he's like, oh, I found you last time. It's like, it almost feels like this whole movie, in terms of their development as like friends, like is like a precursor, like, oh, well, the next movie they're actually gonna be like tight. But the dynamic between the two of them, it's never quite comic, or it never quite lands as comic, even though there's a few funny things or vaguely funny things. I just, some reason it didn't gel to me. These two, like, you know, the two, like, totally different characters that are forced into this situation together. Like, I don't know what it was. And it is funny, because I love Young Guns. And actually, I think I love Young Guns 2 more at the time. But I don't know what it was. It just didn't quite spark. But I think you're right. The action set pieces are probably the most effective parts of this.
Yeah, and you're not wrong there, too. You know, like, you could make the argument that Sutherland's character is trusting Phillips's character, who he kind of, you know, in sort of a play for laughs, but kind of a racist way, keeps referring to him as Chief. Yeah. Diamond Phillips has to be like, my name's not Chief, it's Hank. Yeah. Obviously played for humor at that time. Probably wouldn't.
Which has been currency for several years, Lou Diamond Phillips. You know, yeah. I'm a mystical Indian character, unfortunately. Yeah, go on.
Exactly.
Sorry.
But yeah, you know, like, you could make the argument that knowing that there is a dirty cop in Sutherland's department, that he has nowhere else, he has nobody else to turn to, nobody else to trust, so he has to put his trust in this guy who nurses him back to health, which I will admit that after that whole crazy car chase and Hank Storm sort of rescues Sutherland after being shot, him nursing him back to health, that's where the movie really starts to drag. After that, you know, intense thing, and then he's in the hotel room and he brings his father to nurse him back to health with, you know, with all this sort of mysticism or what have you, kind of nosedives a little bit there, gets a little boring. But then when you would think at that moment, like, oh, this guy nursed me back to health, I have nowhere else to turn to, you would think that that's the connective thing. But as you mentioned, there are these kind of, like, you know, vaguely humorous touches where Sutherland still to that point, like, still wants to work on his own. He does everything in his power to ditch Hank Storm. And those are the funny moments where they're trying to start the car. And then he, like,
yeah,
has you put your, Hank Storm, put your, like, check the engine.
Put your finger on. That is a great bit. I got to say, I love that bit. And you kind of see it coming, but it's still just a great bit where he, you know, flies in reverse and suddenly... Yeah. Goes to the front to shut the hood, and Hank Storm's just like apparently been sitting on the engine the whole time in that full. But yeah, that stuff is great. I think the thing I love that you're totally right, Dino, that it does feel like a real slow ramp up. And I think that he's supposed to be, and that Lou Diamond is supposed to be very stoic in his way and obviously doesn't like this guy and it sees him as responsible for his brother's death. So I think in the way the character Diamond's trying to be true to the character, I think in that he would be slow to warm to this guy that he, you know, sort of directly sees as causing his own brother's death. But there's some great moments of them, and I'm surprised I don't see this in more movies, but I guess I don't see, like, as many shady cop movies where they're looking for guns and they can't find them and they decide to steal them from criminals.
Yeah.
Which is a great gimmick. So they steal guns from a couple different criminals, one of which is Robert Lissardo, mm-hmm. who I spotted right away as one of the moving guys from Moving. You know, he's the one who's like, we're in New Orleans, it's Mardi Gras time, you know, that whole bit. And he's in tons of, like, Robert Lissardo's in tons of movies. I didn't even realize, like, how much he's in. But then there's another great bit where they go into a mob restaurant and steal guns, which is seems really ill-advised.
Yeah.
And then he throws some guy in the trunk, and that's where you get the one smile from Lou Diamond's character where he's just like, okay, that was pretty funny.
Yeah.
That we just tossed the gun. And that's like, but again, I feel like there is at least, you know, there is at least a consistency of the slow build, you know, and that he's really subtle about it. But you're right, it does feel like we're really going to kick into it in Renegades 2,
yeah.
you know, Lost in New York or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it is. I just feel like after that car chase and then, you know, the nursing him back to health, and they kind of go through the predictable infiltration exposition sequences where they're kind of like, you know, hopping around the city, going into all the, you know, like you said, the restaurant and what have you. These are all kind of filtered there. That seems like paint by numbers, like buddy cop formula 101, but still entertaining enough. I guess now is as good a time as ever to mention that we have a repeat guest in this film. Miss Jamie Gertz appears, and she's third billed. She plays Marino, the head villain in this, his girlfriend. And again, she's virtually wasted in a totally underdeveloped role that sees her just being blown to smithereens by Marino's thugs. And in a way that it's like, it's really... violent and savage how, like, brutally she gets shot up. And apparently they Shoulder said that he thought that the sequence was going to be a really emotional one, or at least it was designed to be, and the audience just met it with laughter.
Well, she enters the movie so late, it's hard to really,
right?
I mean, like, yeah, I love her, but dude, you just mentioned her being underused. I think Jamie Gertz is almost always underused. Like, I can't think of too many movies where she's really given a lot, and that's a bummer because I like her. So it is sad to see her show up is almost like a last act, you know, I guess emotional moment for this.
Yeah.
It's too bad.
And I don't understand why either, because again, this not only does this film reunite Sutherland and Lou Diamond Phillips, but it reunites him with Gertz, who they were just coming off of The Lost Boys 2 years ago, which, you know, it's a cliche thing, but when you really do look back at Gertz's credits, like, Lost Boys hands down is one of her best films, because she's given a lot, you know, more to do. She has a lot to kind of spread her wings, and you really appreciate their eye. I would also cite Less Than Zero is probably another one of her best roles. But yeah, she's like, you're totally hit the nail on the head. She's criminally underutilized, and this is supposed to be like her peak era, but, you know, we're talking about two films where, like, man, she's a great talent, and they just did not know how to write better roles for her or utilize her to the best of her abilities.
You don't think Solar Babies was that important of a movie?
I like that movie, but
hold on. I will say this. Again, the second movie in a row that we're discussing where Jamie Gertz just looks annoyed, and her character is annoyed, and that works. She has the best line in the movie, as far as I'm concerned. Maybe I was so starved for some charm between these two characters, regardless of how singularly stoic Lou Diamond Phillips Hank Storm is supposed to be, or whatever, or how it's bizarre to me that a Philadelphia cop decides to trust this random guy, like, even though he saved his life and whatever. But the scene in the department store, okay, where he decides to where Kiefer decides to Buster decides to save Hank from the whole, he broke his hand and he's, you know, because he's a mystical, you know, non-white character, he has some connection to his father and whatever. When he tries to rescue him, he lets go of the Jamie Gertz character, and she decides not to leave, and he turns to her and says, "Why are you still doing here?" She goes, "Nothing in my size." That to me was the funniest line in the
movie.
That
is a good bit. I forgot about that. That joke didn't even land as hard until right now when you mentioned it, because for whatever reason it did. But that is a great bit, because it is like, why the fuck did she not take off? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, totally. I mean, yeah, it's just a shame, because, like, you're right. She does get a great line there, but God, like, she could have been so much better, you know, far better utilized. You know, again, just kind of returning to really what Renegades does best. Again, it's the action. It's those wild car chase sequences, these shootouts. And I think, again, this is something that is worth highlighting in a film like Renegades. It's, you know, this well-orchestrated action that clearly shows a confidence behind the lens that just allows the viewer to observe the carnage unfolding instead of this, you know, contemporary reliance on chaotic quick cutting that's so fucking common in today's action movies. It drives me insane. So it's comforting to watch films from this era where they just knew, plant the camera. You know, this is not the time to be flashy with your camera. You've paid all this production value, all of these talented stunt people and stuff to do what they're here to do. Just capture it. That's all we want. Just capture it so that we can see it. And that's what I think it does really well. It's something that's severely lacking in today's action cinema, I have to say.
Agreed. I got to highlight Robert Knepper as the bad guy. You mentioned him, but just as a bad guy and a loose cannon type bad guy in this movie, I think he's pretty effective. I think he's immediately, you know, Sutherland is an undercover. He gets involved with this diamond heist. And Knepper is sort of the leader, and immediately Knepper's like changing the rules of the deal and, you know, starts shooting people and does shoot Lou Diamond Phillips's brother, right, you know, without any hesitation. And it's just an evil motherfucker in this movie. And so I always do say, like, if you have at least a good villain in your movie, that definitely helps balance things out. And so I think he does a good job of being that guy. I did notice, just as an aside, a movie that I've always meant to see, but I've never seen, is Wild Thing from 1987.
I was just looking at that. I have seen it. It's worth seeing, actually.
You do realize
it was him. I didn't realize it was him. Yeah.
That was almost my selection.
Was that really?
Yeah,
oh, that's
that
amazing.
And then I was like, I went to Renegades, but Wild Thing was like on like my top 5 or 10 to pick for this episode.
I can't remember if I've seen it or not. I just remember somebody picked it on Rupert Pupkin Speaks years ago as a discovery, and I was like, that sounds... I'm reading the Letterboxd synopsis. A child witnesses drug dealers murder his parents. He escapes and grows up in the wild in the city's slums. Years later, he emerges to help residents in the area who are being terrorized by street gangs and drug dealers. So it's like almost like urban Tarzan.
Exactly. And I remember being really stylish,
so he's a star.
But
yeah.
Not bad. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I got his. But now that I like realize it's Robert Knepper, I got to go and watch. And I have the Renegades to Knepper connection. I love, Mike, that you almost picked this one. That's hilarious.
Literally. And I haven't seen it either. I have the Olive Films Blu-ray release, but I was like, late 80s, what late 80s stuff? Because I thought it would be fun to kind of do something that I haven't seen before, kind of, you know, make a new discovery and hopefully expose you guys to it. But yeah, Wild Thing was one of the ones on the list.
Okay, I got to watch it now. There's too much tangential stuff happening here.
I honestly thought it was all right. I haven't seen it in a while. I'm sure I have the tape. But I thought it was okay. Mike, what you said, I got to agree with, honestly. Like, for the shortcomings this movie has, the proficiency of the production of Jack Shoulder, the way the whole thing is managed, like, it hits maybe the best thing you could say about a lot of movies from this period. It hits a certain cruise, like, where it just rolls along smoothly. Even if it's not breaking any particular new ground or throwing any really wild ideas, I think a little bit of the dirty cop twist was a little bit more, you know, a little bit above average, but it's definitely well made for his fourth feature film. Shoulder is clearly like very good at what he does, and it rolled out like it played very well for me. And between the action sequences, even if I didn't get what I was looking for between these two characters, really good performances where they mesh together. You're only going to have like, you know, Grodin and De Niro so many times, I guess.
Yeah.
It definitely plays well. It looks good. Like a lot of the bones of this movie really function well. One of the things I really loved about it is, and maybe this does harken back to some of the superficial commercial things about 80s cinema, mainstream 80s cinema. I like the costumes really, like, I love the idea that after a certain point in this movie, if you've got a receding hairline and a trench coat, you're a dirty cop or a cop. If you've got a ponytail and a suit or a really good hairdo, you're one of the bad guys. Like, it's like the point of, come on, how are you going to, you can't overlook a scene where the two hitmen are both wearing suits and both have ponytails. Yeah. Okay. Like, that's like the slick
greasy ponytails.
Yeah. Rob Knepper has this, the slicked back hair and a turtleneck on. And it's like, I love how deliberately overdressed all the bad guys are. It is funny that Barbara, the Jamie Gertz character, you know, runs a hair salon that all these like really nicely coiffed men destroy. And I love the fact that she runs a hair salon and they all have excellent hair.
Yeah.
If you have a mullet, a ponytail, really nice hairdo, you're one of the bad guys.
Well, they get the best service from Gertz. We clearly know that.
Yeah, but they destroy her place. I mean what's that?
Hilarious.
I will say, you know, just to kind of wrap things up with Renegades, I think Dino kind of hit the nail on the head again. Renegades is a film that doesn't necessarily intend to break new ground within the subgenre, but what I will say about Renegades, and this goes back to what Brian was mentioning about Letterboxd and, you know, or just the idea of the three-star sort of rating, if you will, you know, in an era today where virtually everyone is reaching to the top shelf to bestow something as a masterpiece or just write it off as just utter fucking garbage, there seems to be a very limited capacity for people to kind of find that middle ground on things. And something like Renegades is perfectly serviceable. Yep. And that's great. I love that. That's great. And in a weird sort of way, those types of films kind of end up resonating more, I think, in the long run, because we've gone, you know, roughly 30 minutes on each of these films and have kind of found, you know, the good and the bad. And I don't think that any of us are kind of making the claim that any of these are masterpieces, and certainly not the worst thing you've ever seen. So there's a comfort and a lot to take in the perfectly serviceable. And I think Renegades is another one of those actioneers that delivers and kind of checkmarks all the boxes of being an actioneer at the time, in this buddy formula ilk.
Agreed. Yeah.
I want to also note just a couple of random notes. Again, I was looking for that spark between them. Besides the whole, like, I'm the Indian around here shtick, which, you know, nobody young is going to appreciate those lines. I do like the Buster goes, "You believe that shit?" And his response is, "I am that shit."
Which that was great.
You know, I see what you tried to do there, but that's not exactly one the audience is going to take home. I am that shit, you know. But anyway, I wonder if it was deliberate by the production, but, you know, the movie starts off pretty quickly. Kiefer Sutherland is shot. We've talked about how Hank Storm saves his life. He is shot, and this is 1989, okay? It's not CG, but it's not the 70s either. He is shot and has the most beautiful 70s red paint blood all over him. And I wonder if that was like a deliberate like choice as like referring to like the past, could like in referring to all the great movies that were, you know, from the previous decade where the blood is so wonderfully lurid. It was actually nice to see that. I actually really appreciate it. It's the fact that the blood is that bright.
It could be. I mean, you know, like that could be by design. It's not like, you know, Shoulder was, you know, a stranger to working with blood and gore in any of his films. So that could very well have been an intentional thing.
True enough.
Yeah. Well, this was some whirlwind fun. We can't thank Brian enough for joining us on I Eat Movies number 27. This was a great kind of way to sort of examine, you know, the 1980s cinema on, you know, sort of a truncated manner, where we kind of jumped around dealing with the early, mid, and 80s, late 80s selection. So we hope that you guys appreciated this episode. Again, Brian, thank you so much for joining us. This was such a treat and a pleasure for us.
An absolute delight. Thank you guys again so much. And thank you for allowing me to truncate the format just a little bit for this episode.
No. Absolutely. Anytime. I mean, if you could fit us into your very busy schedule, that, you know, you're welcome back anytime. This was a blast. It's great to see you again, and always great to hear you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for everything you do for educating people about movies, because you do more than pretty much anybody I know, honestly. And you've done it forever, seemingly. So we're ripping off the people that were influenced by you. So
incredibly kind, and I can say the same for your show, which is definitely. I've, you know, mentioned it on Pure Cinema for a reason. You guys have inspired some choices for me, you know, in terms of your selections. You guys are always looking for interesting stuff and digging out, as we've talked about, you know, sometimes the interesting cinema, you know, the stuff that maybe doesn't stand out to a lot of people or is completely forgotten. And I really appreciate it. That's one thing. I love you guys. I love just listening to both of you talk about movies, but I also love the kinds of movies you guys talk about. It's really my kind of show in terms of that. You know, you're not going to necessarily bring in the regular 100 movies that I feel like get talked about on so many podcasts. That's something we just try to avoid. And you guys definitely are always digging for the gems, and I love it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, man. That is really kind, and that is by design. So you guys keep doing what you do, we'll keep doing what we do, and we'll certainly meet again, and you know, hopefully do another one of these collaboration episodes, because this was great fun. Before we do go, Dino, can you let everybody know where they can find us? And Brian, at the end, if you want to, you know, let our listeners know where they can find you, that would be great.
He opened with an apology. You can let him do his plugs first. Jesus.
How dare me. Jesus.
Okay. I am on lots of socials. I'm trying to back off my socials a little bit, but I'm still relatively active on Twitter. Bob Freelander is my main account. Then there's a Just the Disc Pod account for the podcast and the YouTube channel, and a Pure Cinema Pod account for the PCP show. And then we have... I'm Rupert Pupkin Speaks on Instagram, and Just the Disc Pod and Pure Cinema Pod also on Instagram. Those are the two main socials that I use. You know, we have a Facebook group that we encourage people to join. It's a private Facebook group for Pure Cinema. But yeah, I mean, if you're curious about what I'm watching, I'm also on Letterboxd. You can just look up Brian Sauer and find me there. You know, it's like I said, I'm trying to be less active with that stuff, because I do find as I get older, it's just not. It's not worth all the time that I've invested in it, really. Yeah. Not to say the interactions aren't worthwhile, but ultimately it's just like there's so much other stuff I should be doing, you know, than
you could be watching more movies than, you know, being that's on one. Those.
it's an amazing amount of plates you keep spinning. We are I Eat Movies podcast on Facebook and Instagram. And thanks, guys. Just a blast. I'd love to do this again.
Sounds good.
For sure. So until next time, guys, be sure to eat more damn movies. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.